You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and as always, I have with me here my esteemed colleague, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, how are you this week?
Doing really well, actually. Just having a pretty easy week, nothing too exciting going on. Going on a little retreat this weekend, so looking forward to that. It should be nice to get away into the country and just spend some time with some friends. And so, been a good time.
That's good. Now, this retreat, you're not going to the fire caves, right? You're not going to the celestial temple.
No fire caves, no celestial temple, no, you know, Klingon bachelor party, nothing like that. You know,
well,
just
the Klingon
some
bachelor party, that might be fun.
Well, you know, everybody
might get a little rough.
Yeah, everybody thinks it's fun, but Worf let me in on the secret. It's just a bunch of pain and suffering and heat, and this is really three of my most unfavorite things. So I try to stay away from those.
They do have some weird traditions there. You know that bit where the Targ jumps out of the cake? That's just not for me.
That's just not my style. I prefer to have my cake untargued.
Oh, man. All right. So we have gotten a great response to last week's show in which we discussed Sisko as an emissary, an ambassador, or an apostle. I'm really pleased that so many of our listeners enjoy the show because I think we went into some kind of controversial areas there, maybe a little bit, but we've had a great response.
I think it just goes to show just how many fans there are out there who are willing to listen to a good conversation. And, you know, Deep Space Nine really leads to deep conversation. And, you know, it doesn't have to be controversial if it's done with tact and care and just consideration for all points of view. And I think, as we talked about last week, that's one of the things that Deep Space Nine does well with almost every subject that it covers. And so by being able to talk about this show, I think it just lends to understanding on both sides. And that's always a good thing.
Yeah, it really does. And that's what we do here on The Orb as well. And today we're going to talk about another character. We're going to talk about Julian Bashir. Now, Matthew, you and I were discussing off the air a few points about Julian, and he's an interesting character because he's a character that I know a lot of fans really hated in the beginning, and I wasn't particularly fond of him in the beginning either, and I'm still not when I rewatch Deep Space Nine and I see first season Bashir in particular, but he really turned out to be a great character who, like Sisko and Kira, which we've talked about before, went through a lot of growth over the course of seven seasons.
He definitely is one of those characters on this show that has a very clear arc from the beginning to the end. And even though a few of the things that happened in his growth arc, they didn't actually know they were going to happen until they just decided, oh, we need to have something to do here. Speaking specifically of him being genetically enhanced, that was not planned. But it fit very well in the end when they brought it out. And a lot of things from the past in the show, I think, made more sense in light of that kind of revelation. And so, yeah, this is a character that starts off by being kind of a, you know, just a green, eager, kind of oblivious jerk. But, you know, right. So many of us start off like that in life. And so I think one of the things that people didn't like about him is you can kind of see some things reflected in him that you might not really like in yourself, and those are usually the characters we like the least.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said that you see in Bashir, first season Bashir, a man who's really looking for acceptance, and he really wants to be liked and loved by others. Whereas I personally, when I watched him, I saw more of this very young, very arrogant doctor, someone who felt that they knew everything and they were kind of there to show others their superiority in a way, while at the same time, very, I would say, emotionally immature character as well. So I've kind of a little bit of a different take on him, but tell me a little bit about how you saw first season Bashir.
Well, one of the things that I see in Bashir is honestly a little psychoanalysis, is I kind of see a picture of myself as being somebody who spent a lot of time wanting to be liked by people, wanting to be accepted. And, you know, we know from later on that Bashir is hiding himself all of this time. You know, he has spent his entire life not being who he is. And when you do that, what you really want is just to be able to be you. But you also kind of lose a sense of even who you are as a person, because you spend so much time pretending to be somebody else, you don't even know who you are anymore. And that causes a lot of emotional issues. And so this kind of, I think, idea of him being emotionally young and a little immature, I think comes from the fact that he's never ever been able to be just him, who he is, which is somebody who's genetically enhanced, who's, you know, is smarter than everybody else in the room, except for maybe somebody like Dax, or Data, obviously, if he's in the same room with Data, which he was in Birthright. And so, you know, often he is having to hold himself back. And, you know, with the youthful exuberance he has as well, it kind of just overflows, I think, into this kind of annoyingness that happens in the first season. And so when I watch that back, I have a lot of compassion for him. But mainly it's because I'm kind of placing myself in that character's shoes and I'm seeing a lot of me in it. And I don't really like me from the past either. So I kind of caught him a little bit of slack.
Interesting. So the way you describe this, it's interesting that because of the way Bashir evolved over the course of Deep Space Nine, when they made the decision to have him be genetically enhanced, then when we go back now and we watch Deep Space Nine, we can watch Bashir with the knowledge that he's genetically enhanced. And we can maybe read motivation into a lot of his actions like that.
Yeah, it is one of the things I think that makes that revelation really interesting for the show and for the character and for continuing to rewatch the show, because new things keep popping up. And I think that this too leads to his, you know, kind of arrogant nature. He's not used to being wrong. He's used to being right because he is genetically enhanced. He probably always does have the answer. And it would be hard to not, at that point, want to use that to show off, especially for the ladies, as he does try to do so often.
Oh, yes. I love it when he tells the Bajoran women about his tests at the academy. And
yes.
And Miles is over there rolling his eyes. Gets them yeah. every time.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. This just came up as you were describing that. Do you think that someone like Bashir, who's genetically enhanced, you said he's accustomed to always being right, he will intentionally answer a question incorrectly on a test at the academy. It takes me back actually thinking about the Enterprise D, thinking about the TNG characters, that these people who are in Starfleet, when they're at the academy or they're at Starfleet Medical or they're on a starship like the Enterprise, they're in this very structured environment where, you know, everything is pretty much well-oiled, except for, of course, the occasional holodeck malfunction or problem with the warp engines. But
right.
Structurally, like, there's no conflict. there's, you can be the smartest doctor, you can be the smartest crew member, and you can work within the structure of that organization. And he's used to that, even though he's young here, but he's used to that. Then he comes to a place like Deep Space Nine, where he has to deal with someone like Kira. He has to deal with someone like Garak. I think it takes him out of that element. And even though he may be smarter than everyone else, suddenly his view of what the world is and how he fits into it is suddenly changed drastically. And then he has to start kind of fumbling around and try to adapt to that.
Well, and it becomes the classic problem of having book smarts and street smarts. And, yeah. You know, Bashir has no street smarts. He is right. Definitely the smartest person in the room if you want to know about pre-ganglionic fibers. But he's not the smartest person when it comes to knowing what it's like to have that kind of persecuted life that somebody like Garak or Kira has had. He doesn't have any idea what it's like to you know, well, I guess I shouldn't say that. He has been poor because his family has never had much.
Right.
But he has definitely made something out of what he's been given. And
I think there's a difference. Like, as a child, he was very slow, and that's why his parents decided to have him genetically enhanced. But the thing is that, so he was genetically enhanced around the age of 7. Now, I think most of us don't have very many memories before age 5. Like, we, as we're a kid, we remember things, but as we get older, we kind of forget and forget. And so, and I think it depends on the environment that you're raised in as well, you know, and what kind of family structure you had. Like, for me personally, I have very few memories before age 5. Now, I do remember, you know, like, from age 7, I pretty much remember everything. But when we talk about having a life that involves hardships or strife or persecution, like Kira having to fight against the Cardassians, Garak being basically exiled from his own culture, which he obviously loves very dearly, this is something that I think Bashir has never experienced as an adult. And so even though his family may have been poor and he may have had those hardships, you know, I'm sure he was persecuted by their children for being slow when he was young. It's something he probably doesn't remember that well. And it doesn't really impact, I think, how he starts to adapt to this new situation.
I definitely think you're right. You know, especially that episode where we learn that he's genetically enhanced, and he talks about that he knew he was slower, you know, but the moment the enhancements start to take over, everything changes for him. And so really that's when his life kind of begins as he knows
right.
it. And you're right. At that point, you know, he is always the smartest person. And so he doesn't really have to learn some of the ways that other people do. And he's so devoted to learning from his books that I don't think he has a lot of time, you know, to pursue other goals except for, you know, the ladies later on. And let's be honest, he doesn't seem to be that successful. And so not a lot is keeping him from his books.
Well, let's talk about him as a ladies' man for just a moment, because on the original series, of course, Kirk was the ladies' man. And on The Next Generation, Riker was the ladies' man. And, you know, I feel like in Star Trek and in television, you need to have that character on a show. Writers typically, you know, you're going to have someone like that on the cast. And I feel like in this case, they made Bashir that character, but with a big difference, which is that unlike Kirk and Riker, who both had experience and charisma, and
the vibe.
They were charming and they had the vibe, Bashir had none of that. And he was so enthralled by Jadzia. And he's like a little puppy dog around Jadzia. And she is probably younger than him. in terms of Julian and Jadzia, but in terms of Julian and Dax, she's obviously this much, much older, wiser person. And, you know, it came to be the case where, of course, my dear friend Tanya and I came up with a verb for this, which is to bashir someone. When you look at someone gazingly and longingly, you are bashiring someone, because that is exactly what he did for the first season and a half, anyway, of Deep Space Nine.
He does really have a focus on her. And, you know, again, with kind of an understanding nature towards Bashir, because I was much like this, this idea of, you know, when you want to be accepted by people, you want to have somebody know you, you want to be loved, you kind of pour that out on just about anybody who will pay attention to you. You try to make everybody the one at that point. And Bashir's really that character who's, he's longing for connection with somebody special. He does want that. He doesn't just want to be the ladies' man. And so he kind of just, it comes out on everybody because he's trying to find some kind of fulfillment there. And as a character, I can definitely relate to that. And yes, he really, though, does have a special place in his heart for Jadzia, and always does. And I think one of the most heartbreaking things to me in the series was when Ezri tells Bashir that it would have been him if Worf hadn't come along. And just, I think, how painful that would be to actually know that he was so close, and that she had those kind of feelings for him. That kind of thing never goes away.
That's a good insight into his behavior, because on a superficial level, as I was describing, it does seem that he was simply the ladies' man on the show, except the writers, because it's Deep Space Nine, they were building in perfect characters instead of making him the super charming William T. Riker. They made him the young, unsure Julian Bashir. But as you describe it, again, like I said, if we go back and we rewatch season one of Deep Space Nine with these eyes, a lot of that makes a bit more sense. While we're talking about Dax here, I'm just going to jump ahead to the end of the show for a minute. And we talk about how he approached Jadzia Dax, and then what happened with Ezri Dax at the end. So from a relationship standpoint and a maturity of character, how do you see the Bashir that was together with Ezri?
Well, it's so interesting because at that point, you know, Ezri has switched. So she's the one who's unsure of herself and not quite as mature. You know, Bashir at that point is much more mature as a character and as a person than Ezri is. And he's much more sure of who he is, and he knows that really well. She doesn't really at that point. And so they've kind of switched roles in some ways. And by the end of the series, you know, Ezri is becoming more and more comfortable with herself. And I think that this leads to the fact that they always had feelings for one another. And Ezri can see the value and the loyalty of somebody like Bashir. You know, Bashir is somebody who is very loyal. You know, he's best friends with Miles and stays best friends with him. That's never going to change because, you know, once you're Bashir's friend, he's not going to let that go. I think the maturity and the wisdom with which he approaches Ezri in the beginning too, he doesn't jump all over her. He doesn't do any of those things he used to do with women.
Right.
He just pursues her as a friend would, and as somebody to be there for her, to help her grow. And that's selfless love. That's a completely different type of character. And I think that's a really cool character arc for him to go from just being somebody who's so selfish and worried about, you know, somebody loving me and wanting me and all those kind of things. And he's instead learned to be there for others, for what they need. And in the end, it really works out for him to be able to end up with the woman that he was always in love with, just strangely shorter.
Strangely shorter. That's true. So another character development that I wanted to touch on while we talk about Bashir and how he came to terms with this new environment that he was in and how it changed him is this very interesting relationship that he formed with Garrick from very early on in the series. Now, I think he didn't quite know what to make of someone like Garrick.
Well, you know, that's one of those things that made Deep Space Nine so interesting, and especially because we've all come from a very Starfleet-centered world. From TOS to The Next Generation, you know, everybody that we deal with on a regular basis on our shows has been from Starfleet, and we're not used to somebody telling lies the way that Garrick would, just because he wants to stay in practice, you know, and always bending the truth. So even if there is some truth in there, you can't really tell which part is truth and which part is lies, because he's just so good at it. And this is the kind of character that, you know, you don't really find on Starfleet Academy's campus every day. And so when you get to Deep Space Nine, when Bashir gets to Deep Space Nine and comes in contact with somebody like Garrick, this is completely unheard of, you know, unless you're on a space station in Starfleet, you're not really going to run into these type of people all that much, except for in first contact situations and, you know, dealing with the Cardassians, maybe every once in a while when your ship passes their, border.
But even then, you're not going to deal with a Cardassian who has been removed from everyday Cardassian society the way
right.
Garrick has.
Exactly.
Garrick was a very multifaceted Cardassian, usually, except for someone like Dukat, who was a very multifaceted character. The majority of the Cardassians that we saw on The Next Generation, especially, and on Deep Space Nine, up until the point where we got deep into the war, where we had a few more characters like Damar, they were very much, you know, these are Cardassians. They're kind of this militaristic society. They don't like Starfleet. That's kind of what we got. So he would not have had any interaction with a Cardassian like Garrick.
Right. And one of the neat things to watch is that their relationship really helps mature Bashir throughout the years. It makes Bashir more guarded, a little bit more cynical, but I think in some ways a good way. It gives him the ability to see beyond what's happening on the surface and look really to what's happening underneath somebody.
Yeah.
I think he learns how to watch people and all of those kind of things. And then, you know, I believe he gets to put that genetically engineered brain to work when he gets all of those things. And I think he becomes probably somebody that would be almost like a human lie detector because he's learned from a master. And you can see that by the end of the show, especially when he's dealing with Sloan in Section 31. He can pretty much see through Sloan most of the time because he's spent so much time with somebody like Garrick.
Right. Yeah, he doesn't see through Sloan because he's genetically enhanced and he has some magical ability, right? It's because he has been seasoned through his experiences on the space station, and I think especially through his friendship with Garrick, to be able to see the world in that way. You know, yesterday I was watching Hippocratic Oath, and at the end of Hippocratic Oath, because there's that B-plot about Worf and Odo having kind of a conflict over who's going to be in charge of security on the station. And at the end of that, Sisko tells Worf, and it's an actual quote, and I love it because it's a DS9 character talking to a TNG character. Sisko tells Worf, "Let's just say DS9 has many more shades of gray." And I think that this is also what Garrick taught Bashir, that this station has many more shades of gray. The world here isn't what you came from in Starfleet.
Yes, and I think that that is one of the best lessons that Bashir could learn, being somebody who does start off the show being very black, very white. You know, it's all, there's not a lot in between there. He doesn't even understand what's in between, and the fact that there is something there. And Garrick definitely brings that out. And I think what's really neat to see is how the storyline, again, really helps, because, you know, all of these sessions with Garrick really lead Julian to be able to handle somebody like Sloane once he comes along. And that whole Section 31 plot line, and the fact that, you know, Bashir has been somebody who loves playing, you know, Julian Bashir type Hollow novels where he's a spy and all that kind of stuff. And all of that works together to culminate in a story like, you can be a real spy. You can be a part of an organization that you've, you know, been playing with for real. But the things we do, you're not going to be so happy with. And having to then deal with all that gray that Sisko talked about. You know, if he hadn't met Garrick, I don't think he would have been able to handle somebody like Sloane and be able to say no.
Let's talk about handling gray in a medical sense for a moment. And this is another way where I see Bashir evolving. Maybe he always felt this way, but you really see it in the character. When we get in season four, when we get to Hippocratic Oath, and Bashir and O'Brien are stranded on this planet, and there are these Jem'Hadar who are trying to break away from the Dominion. For O'Brien, it's a very black and white situation. It's very much, these are Jem'Hadar, they are Dominion, we don't help them. It doesn't matter if they're suffering, it doesn't matter what they need, we don't help them, they are the enemy. Period. But Bashir put all of those concerns to the side, and he's really looking at the bigger picture, I think, that not only as a doctor, his Hippocratic Oath to help those who are suffering, but he's also thinking, I think, about, in terms of gray, how helping these Jem'Hadar might change the nature of how Jem'Hadar see Starfleet. Maybe this could be the beginning of some turning point. Now, at this point, you know, the Dominion War is not full on or anything, but there are concerns going on here.
Yeah, I really, really enjoy that episode because of the conversations that they both have to have. And, you know, Miles is really probably the only character who changes very little on Deep Space Nine. He's pretty much the same type of character. He's always the everyman. He's always...
And he came into the show already somewhat developed compared to the other characters.
But you can see there that nice interplay between him and Julian, who really has been progressing and learning. And I think this is, again, where when you watch back and you think that he's genetically enhanced, you can tell that he probably is thinking very long term and what were the repercussions for the entire Alpha Quadrant and Gamma Quadrant would be if Jem'Hadar are no longer addicted to Ketracel White, and how that might destabilize the Dominion and help the Federation and, you know, avert a war if the Founders don't have their killing machines anymore. And so thinking about all that, and then too, just the general compassion that all doctors have for somebody who is their patient. And the moment they see somebody in need, something in them just starts to take over. It doesn't really matter who they are, even if it's an enemy, they have the compassion to want to heal that person. And I think Julian, especially in that episode or an episode like The Quickening, really does a great job in showing just he is a great doctor when it comes to Starfleet doctors. Very committed to his patients and to finding an answer to things, even when it seems hopeless.
And he keeps digging. You know, let's not forget that he also is the person who found the cure. Well, he uncovered the Starfleet plot of genocide against the changelings. And he also... Right. Created a cure for that disease, which ultimately ended up being what probably saved billions of more lives by bringing an end to the war.
Yes, definitely. And you know, what's the neat about him as a doctor is the fact that anytime you walk into the infirmary in Deep Space Nine, he is almost always sitting at his desk doing some kind of research, because that's just who he is. He's always trying to solve a problem that maybe somebody else can't solve, and he is arrogant enough in a good way to think that he can solve it. And I think that that really shows his conviction, and it shows his dedication to what he does as a person, and then as a doctor. And that's really neat. You know, obviously so many people make fun of Crusher in TNG, but you know, on Deep Space Nine, Bashir is not a doctor that you can make fun of for anything like that. He's
really
fully
not
dedicated. Yeah. And I think it's funny, we're talking about this before the show, and you know, he's the kind of guy who's so dedicated and kind of geeky in his work that he'll be bored at night when all of his friends are busy with their, you know, significant others, which he doesn't have at that point, and he'll be fighting a virus that he's been fighting for weeks trying to figure it out. That's what he does in his off time for fun, you know. I mean, so even when he's doing things that are, you know, generally more fun for him, it usually has a bent towards himself as a doctor trying to solve a problem.
Right. That's why he wrote that very popular 24th century pad app, Sim Virus, that was all the rage on Federation.
Oh my
Starships.
Gosh, I can't stop playing it. Oh my goodness. Like, I'm right now, I'm on my phone and I'm playing Sim Virus, and oh, it just mutated again. I'll be right back.
Well, you know, that's how he paid for all his little figures, that for his playtime with Miles was through in-app purchases.
That's true. That's true. You'd be jealous of his Kirk Bear collection.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, speaking of him as being such a capable doctor, what did you think about the whole idea of Starfleet using Bashir as a template for the LMH, or the long-term medical hologram?
I thought that that was a great idea, actually. I really liked the fact that, again, you know, on Deep Space Nine, they're taking the idea of, you know, the emergency medical hologram and using that as a story point. You know, we had already been watching Voyager at that point and realized, well, this could be something that you could maybe need for more long-term needs on a starship or a starbase or something like that. And so I just loved that they picked up that idea and decided, all right, well, we're going to do that. We're going to do it on our show, and we'll use Bashir. And I thought that was great. You know, having them choose, obviously, a doctor that we know, and it's on our show to use the LMH, it was a lot of fun. And then, of course, getting to have Lewis Zimmerman come on the show. And so it's really just Robert Picardo, who we're all enjoying, because he's always amazing, and getting to see him, of course, then that's the big revelation of who Julian really is. So I actually really like that episode. I think it's fantastic. Plus, there's a great scene with Lita in it, and if you don't remember what it is, just go back and watch the episode again. You'll enjoy it.
That did lead us to a very good episode. I mean, of course, the LMH is used as a plot device to reveal the genetic enhancement of Bashir. And prior to that, you know, Bashir had many medical successes. I mean, you wonder why would Starfleet choose such a young doctor? But he had so many medical successes. He had done so much research. But towards the end of season four, we had the quickening, which is another story that I think showed Dr. Bashir's ingenuity and his determination to help other people and to solve medical problems. And so maybe Starfleet looks at all the service record and they decide, well, okay, this is the guy that we need.
Well, and he was also the youngest nominee in the history of the Carrington Award. And so I do think you're right. You know, Starfleet looked at the service records of the different doctors, and they found that this is a standout among their staff, and this would be somebody who would be good to use. I mean, obviously, too, they were probably looking for somebody who has a good bedside manner, unlike the doctor.
Right.
Because Lewis Zimmerman wasn't known for his bedside manner.
While we're in this episode, Dr. Bashir, I presume, what did you think? And I would actually do another show where we really, really talk about this topic. But up to this point in Star Trek, genetic engineering was always presented as bad because we had Khan, we had genetic engineering, and we know what happened because of Khan and those supermen. And so the Federation has these laws in place to prohibit genetic engineering. But again, what I think Deep Space Nine did here, and whether you think it's right or wrong is a really big discussion, but Deep Space Nine, by using Bashir in particular, I think showed that genetic engineering itself, while a controversial issue, is not a black and white issue. It's not always for bad. Sometimes it could be for good. You think about, I mentioned before, him finding a cure to the virus that had been introduced to the changelings. You know, I don't know if any doctor would have been able to do that the way that he did, and in time, if he weren't genetically engineered to be as intelligent as he was. So I think Deep Space Nine is showing that there is a bad side to genetic engineering, there's a good side to genetic engineering, and let's see what you believe and how it plays out. But what did you think about this revelation about Bashir?
Well, I thought it was really interesting, and I thought it made a lot of things, you know, make sense for the character. I also thought it was great that Star Trek finally touched an issue which, you know, we deal with so much now, and not as much then, but we do more now in the idea of, you know, cloning and all of these kind of things and everything that science can do. And sometimes we're worried about science taking over. And so Deep Space Nine touching on this issue of genetic engineering in a way that did show that there could be positive benefits from this. And yet Deep Space Nine does, again, remind us after this with, you know, the other genetically engineered people that he gets to meet.
Right. Well, we have statistical probabilities, which really shows many of the side effects of genetic engineering.
Exactly. And just how lucky Bashir was. You know, he's really an anomaly. And because it becomes so difficult to tweak things like the human brain, because even in Star Trek, they still don't understand exactly what makes our brains tick in that way. And so when you start to mess with everything, the calibrations get off and things like, you know, the characters we meet in statistical probabilities happens. And then, of course, you know, again, they show us how good Bashir is as a doctor when he's able to actually help Serena Douglas come out of her, you know, kind of catatonic state almost. You know, she is so locked into herself, she cannot interact with anyone. And it's through his knowledge and understanding as somebody who's genetically enhanced and to be able to think outside the box with the help of his friends at that point to be able to help her and to bring her out of that and make her actually a productive member of society, just like himself. And so throughout all of that, the issue is still very gray. Deep Space Nine leaves it for us to figure it out for ourselves, not to tell us what's right and wrong. But I think the main message is that this is something that is not supposed to be treated lightly. And I think that's a good message to leave us with.
Let's talk about Serena for just a moment, now that you brought her up, because we talked about how he was Bashiring Jadzia in the beginning. And we talked about his relationship with Ezri at the end of the series. The way he interacted with Serena was something that I just can't picture this character doing early on. What did you see in that? What did the way that he interacted with her? Serena Douglas, again, is the woman who was genetically manipulated, who was extremely shy. I mean, she didn't even speak to anyone. What did you see in the way he interacted with her? What did that tell you about Bashir and his growth up to that point? Because I think at that point, when is the first time we see her? Is it season 6 or 5? I think it's 6, isn't it?
It's season 6, Statistical Possibilities. And, you know, she doesn't talk or anything. And, you know, she's just a very quiet character who's just locked inside of herself. And I think what Bashir shows us is just how much he's learned. And yet still what's really driving him. And I think this was where we just watched this episode, my girlfriend and I, the other night on our rewatch. And this is where the episode really hit me of who Bashir really is. What's been driving him his whole life is this idea to be loved and accepted and to have somebody who's going to be there and understand him, because he's had to hide his whole life and nobody has understood him and nobody really can understand him because he's thinking on a level that would baffle everyone except for Data. He's that smart. Or, you know, maybe somebody like Spock. But really what he wants is just to have somebody to be there. And that whole episode, he's struggling with all of his friends are in relationships. He's not in one. He's alone. And, you know, I think we can all relate to that fact of kind of having been in that position where all of our friends have paired off and we're not that person. And we're kind of left at home to sit at play Xbox or read a book or watch a movie by herself because there isn't really anybody to hang out with. And then she comes along and brings out a side in him and a joy in him because finally there's somebody who not only thinks on his level, but sometimes exceeds his level and is challenging to him and is can understand him and accept him in all the ways that he needs the most. And I thought it was a beautiful story. And yet, you know, obviously, he moves a little bit too fast, but at the same time, he's able to let go. And that's, I think, the thing that really sets this apart, is that he not only stops, but he can actually realize what he's doing in the first place. He has that realization and he can move forward and let her go. I think that was real character growth for somebody like Bashir.
This desire to have someone who's always there for him, I think it explains a lot of what so many of us lovingly call his bromance with Miles. But that was also an interesting relationship, and it's the last relationship that I want to touch on today, just in the interest of time. They kind of didn't get along with each other in the beginning, and I think Miles, being the everyday man, really did see Bashir as irritating and arrogant. And but they were brought together, you know, by circumstances, especially when everyone thought they were dead, when they had to go and they had to disarm those were they genetic weapons, and they were killed, you know, to cover up the evidence, and everyone thought that they were gone. I think that was in Armageddon Game, I believe it was. That kind of helped to bring them together a little bit. And then their friendship grew and grew. And they definitely, I think, became the two closest people on the station, really. And we like to joke that Keiko knows what's going on. And she's fine with it. She's fine with it. But because you do get the feeling often that Miles wishes that Jules was his wife instead of Keiko, right? I get that feeling at times. But I think it's because they can really understand one another, and they can associate with one another as just bros, right? And that's what they are through the series. And as you described to me, as you're talking about what maybe he saw in Serena, I think that he really found that in Miles.
I think you're right. And I think with them too, they're kind of that classic opposites attract as friends, you know. They're very much the odd couple. They are Felix and Jack. They come from two different ways of doing things. And, you know, him being, Miles being that everyman and Julian being that kind of like creative and just kind of whimsical type person. You bring those two people together and they're going to help each other grow. They're going to help each other become, you know, more rounded people. And I think by the end of the show, you can see just the way that they've both kind of rubbed off on each other in a very platonic way, I might say. But Miles has, I think, learned a few things from Julian about how to have a little bit more fun and loosen up. And I think Julian has learned a little bit more pragmatism from Miles, and just how to look at things with not quite so excited mentality all the time. And yeah, this is a great relationship on the show. And I think, honestly, you know, we talked about in our character episode, it's probably the best relationship on the show.
Yeah, I think that Miles did teach Julian a lot about relationships, because you said earlier that Miles is probably the character that developed the least over the course of the series. And again, I think it's because he came into the show fairly well developed from The Next Generation. And maybe it's also because Colm Meaney is just such a natural actor that I always feel like I'm just watching him when I see this and when I watch Miles. But as a married man, I think that Miles, because of his relationship with Keiko, had a lot that he could teach someone like Julian, if that person is receptive to seeing it, because it's very difficult to maintain a marriage. You know, I mean, that's, you talk about relationships and someone you're with all the time, year after year after year, and the way that you start to merge with one another in terms of your personalities and the way you think, and, you know, the way that you have to work to get along as well. And that is something I think that Miles offered Julian, as much as we like to joke about, you know, maybe he wishes Julian were Keiko. You know, and a lot of people don't like Keiko, actually. And a lot of people don't like the whole Miles-Keiko thing. But Keiko and Miles and that relationship, and as it's portrayed on Deep Space Nine, as annoying as it can be at times, it was a very realistic relationship, especially within the context of Star Trek.
Well, and one of the neat things that Miles does for Julian, I think, is what you were saying, is he gives him a realistic look at what it's like to actually have a real relationship.
Yeah.
It's not all fireworks and roses and fancy dinners and enjoying the holodeck together all the time. It's everyday life. It's having kids. It's all of the things that go along with having kids. And, you know, it's going to be tough, and you're going to have fights, and you're not going to like each other sometimes. But that's what real life and what real love is learning to live together in a way that's lovingly sacrificial for the benefit of the other person. And Miles and Keiko, you know, yeah. I don't love Keiko either. I think sometimes just the way she's played was kind of obnoxious, and written was kind of obnoxious. So I don't blame the character so much, just kind of the way she's written.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I really do see that being a good representation of what true marriage is like. It's about loyalty. It's about fidelity. And it's about real, true, deep, loving care for the other person. And you're right. One of the best things that Miles does is not to preach it, oh, Bashir, about what he should be. It's just to lovingly show him through his actions what he should be.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. All right. Well, we should wrap up our talk of Bashir. We'll certainly come back to some specific topics. But in closing, I wanted to ask you to just tell me, big picture, what is your takeaway from Bashir from start to finish, from what we got in Emissary to what we got in What You Leave Behind?
what I get from Bashir from watching the entire series is the picture of the growth of somebody who goes from being young and very vibrant and a little bit overzealous in almost everything he does, to being somebody who becomes tempered, learns what it means to be a real man, learns what it means to care very deeply for other people and not just himself, and also learns what it means to be a good friend, to love a woman well, all of those kind of things. This is a great character arc when you watch through it. And it's about a man, I think, learning to set aside himself for the betterment of those around him as well. And he does that as a doctor. He does that as a friend. He does that as a boyfriend in the end as well to Ezri. And so all of these things put together, this is a great character arc. It's another triumph for Deep Space Nine and the writers here. And honestly, Julian is one of my favorite characters on this show. And as we talked about, for me, it's quite personal. When I watch this, I see a lot of myself in this character. And sometimes it's kind of uncomfortable to see some of those things that I really did not enjoy about myself and glad that I got past, just like Julian did. I still have some ways to go, but this is a great character. What were the things that you think of, Chris, when you look back on him from start to finish?
Well, we talked about him being a great doctor, and I think that his medical skill and his devotion to his research and to medicine and to helping others, that was consistent from start to finish. I don't think that ever was in question. I don't think it ever wavered, and it was very solid. I think that my takeaway from it is that in the beginning, we had someone, as we said, who was very book smart, who was very intelligent, but wasn't actually prepared to deal with the real world in the way that you need to on a day-to-day basis. And he looked at everything from a very analytical standpoint. And he might have covered that up a bit, you know, with his exuberant pursuit of Jadzia and such. But he was there, he was ready, he was going to make a difference in the wilderness. And he approached it from a young point of view. By the end, I think we got someone who understood how the world really works, understood how to take that ability to analyze things from an academic standpoint and to analyze them from a real world standpoint, and became someone who was very strong in his convictions. And as we said, very, very loyal. And he was just such a different character at the end of the series than he was at the beginning. So I do agree with you that it is one of the great character arcs in Deep Space Nine, even though I think it's often overshadowed by Sisko's arc, of course, and the very, very complex story of Kira as well.
Definitely.
And on that note, Matthew, let's let everyone get back to their Ractigenos and their Dabo and whatever they're doing tonight. But first, let's tell people how to contact us. If you would like to send us a message, share your thoughts with us on Bashir, you can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there, and that will come to Matthew and myself. You can find us over on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, where we have a rapidly growing community. And you'll find us all the time on Twitter under username trekfm. Now, Matthew, what if people want to look you up?
Well, of course, I am on Trek FM as the book reviewer and on Literary Treks as well with you, my esteemed colleague. And you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02, trying there to tweet about all sorts of different things. Obviously, Star Trek, Deep Space Nine, other books I'm reading, sports ball, all of these kind of things. To enjoy following me. So I hope you will. Just give me an at reply. Let me know you're following me. And let me know what you're thinking, and especially about the show, something you might want to hear on the show. We'd love to hear that kind of thing. And so, thank you in advance.
And definitely, we want to thank everyone for your feedback as well, both on iTunes and in the messages that you've sent and on Twitter. It's been a real delight, actually, to see how people have received the orb so far and are enjoying our discussions of Deep Space Nine. If you want to find me, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is cbrianjones, and you can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that username, and that's Brian with a Y. And, of course, I talk about Star Trek, also sports ball, just like Matthew, design, Japan, music, all kinds of stuff. So look me up and send me an at reply. Say hello.
Well, Chris, I gotta go. Morn just called, and he wants to play some more of that nice sim game that we've been talking about. And so I'll see you later.
Okay, well, enjoy that, and don't spend all of your gold press latinum on those in-out purchases.
I'll try not to.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on The Orb.